This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Michigan Campaign Finance Network Director Craig Mauger breaks down the totals from last year's state house races, including the three Southwest Michigan districts where more than $1 million was raised and spent. But first, aside from the results, the legacy of the 2016 election may be the term fake news. A panel discussion is being held on Monday evening at 7 o'clock in Western Michigan University's Lee Honors College. The program, sponsored by the WMU Libraries, is called How to Catch Fake News Before It Catches You. We're joined by two of the people who will be on that panel. Sue Ellen Christian is a journalism professor, and Peter Wielhauer, a political science professor at Western Michigan University. Thank you both for being here.
Glad to be here.
It's a pleasure.
Should note that the third person on that panel will be MLive regional news manager Mickey Shikilo. So let me begin by having both of you give me a definition. What would you say is fake news? Sue Ellen?
Well, fake news is not news that you simply don't agree with. It is not shoddy reporting or reporting that needs corrections or clarification. Fake news is deliberately false or misleading in a substantive way.
Peter?
I think that's a great idea. It's important for us to distinguish between news that is intentionally false in order to accomplish some other goal and news that is simply incorrect in the moment.
Is it new? I mean, we heard a lot about it in the 2016 election, but is fake news something that people have been trying in one way or another to disseminate to the public for a longer period of time?
Since the printing press, we've had fake news, and it's truly, and in fact, longer than we've had straight news reporting over the 500 or so years of printed press, we have had deliberately misleading news to get an audience. And that's what's at the heart of this, is trying to catch people's eyeballs. The difference is that now with the digitization of information, we have news that's highly shareable, and you can package stories so that you have a visual that's highly engaging with content that may or may not go with that visual. You have shocking headlines and clickbait, and all of those, of course, are 21st century phenomena.
I think it's not new. I think we've seen this, and I agree with Sue Ellen, although the history on this, in terms of when it actually started, I'm not as familiar with. But certainly when we look at the history of American politics, the era of the party presses was one in which they were the dominant sources of news for the vast majority of Americans. Over time, that evolved into a more of an industrial, professionalized idea of journalism, where we got a sense that there's some objectivity, there are codes of ethics and performance. And then with the democratization, if you want, of news gathering and information distribution, I think that Sue Ellen is exactly on point in terms of saying this creates all kinds of new tools that are old techniques, but with much more power and much greater reach than they ever had before.
And the technology is perhaps one of the things that makes it a little easier to fool people. I'm thinking that a chain email looks like a chain email, whereas a fake news story can look like the New York Times. It can look like the Wall Street Journal if someone is very good at web design and those sort of things. And there's a lot of people out there now that have those skills.
Well, and I think that part of what complicates this is not just the fake news stories and the, in the short term, incorrect news stories, but also news stories that come across through a Facebook news feed, for example, that look like news stories, but that are in fact opinion pieces. So one of the things that I frequently actually get tripped up by is I'll see a headline come through the New York Times or a headline come through Politico that looks like a news headline. And when I click through, it turns out it's actually in their op-ed section. So my advice in this area is to keep in mind that you have to go look actually at the source and what is this news? Or is this just an opinion that is easy to distribute? Because it's hard to tell that on the surface.
To piggyback on what you just said, Pete, I think the viral nature of online media allows fake news to happen. And it's so easy to share via Facebook. And most of our younger generations get their news from Facebook. So that is just a phenomenon that's really difficult to stop because it's the number one source of news for people who are 35 and under.
I don't want to just lay it on at the feet of the millennials, however. I have a lot of friends in my Facebook feed who are not millennials, and they are just as prone, the older generations, people who are my age or maybe not quite as old as me, but are older, that they frequently are, they just are not as critical in their thinking, and they'll spread these fake news stories because of the problems that I'm sure we'll get to, that, you know, it reinforces their preconceived ideas about what they want to be true.
And I mean, we should go there right now. The idea that partisanship is a lot of what's driving this, that if you are a conservative and you read something that says something horrible about Hillary Clinton, maybe you're more likely to believe it. If you are someone who is liberal and you see a fake news story that says something ridiculous about Donald Trump, it sounds maybe a little more plausible just because of your political beliefs. And I'm also wondering if the people who are putting it out there have have moneyballed this, if we can use that term, that they know the analytics and they know the types of audiences they can reach with certain stories.
I think there's a lot to unpack in that.
Yeah.
We've known for a long time in terms of political science research and communications research that people are prone to evaluate political people, presidents, Congress, and so forth, based upon their own partisanship, their own cognitive framework. And so that gives them a basis for saying these things are true, these things are false, this person is bad, this person is good. I even use an example frequently in my class of people and whether they think the president is responsible for rises in gas prices. And when the Democrats hold the White House, Republicans are much more likely to say that the president controls gas prices. When Republicans in office, they say the president can't control gas prices. So a lot of our political evaluation is colored by the cards that we bring to the table.
So I guess another question here, and let me preface this by saying that there have been a couple studies which have said that fake news did not alter the outcome of the 2016 election. So important to preface it with this. But at the same time, is it effective? I mean, if you are a purveyor of fake news, if you're someone that is trying to disseminate it, is it a good way to try and move the needle one way or another, try to get candidates elected, maybe try to get an issue that you care about to go one way or another?
Well, I think in terms of identifying whether these ads are effective, we have to ask, what do we mean by effective? Does it change opinions? Does it change votes? Does it reinforce opinions and make people even stronger? Or does it cause them to question their commitment to a particular candidate? If we think effective means it changes people's votes, it wouldn't be surprising to me that these things would not change people's votes, because we are so polarized in the public that people already have their pre-existing framework. They like where they are, and what they like is news that reinforces what they already believe. So a bad Hillary Clinton headline is not going to all of a sudden make Hillary Clinton supporters really contemplate the meaning of life and the universe and everything, and then think, wow, Donald Trump really is better than Hillary Clinton. It's not going to go there. But when we look at, do people's views get reinforced and strengthened and deepened? My sense is that probably is the case. But again, giving a caveat, I don't think we have good research on that quite yet. It's too early since the election.
But we do know in general that people on social media exist in a filter bubble. A lot of people, unless they're really actively pursuing alternate sources of information, that idea of reinforcement just in general, whether it's partisan views or not, that they run in circles of like-minded people. We know that from the whole filter bubble phenomenon on social media. Pete, you bring up an interesting point about why do people do fake news? You know, why commit fake news? And partisanship certainly seems to be one of the themes. I think it's important to note also that it makes money.
Absolutely.
And so through clicks on ads and through, you know, viral traffic, it can be very lucrative. There have been news reports of people who have made $35,000 a year from their, you know, apartment just writing fake news stories. And the other motivation often is for parody, or it's a joke. Sometimes too often the joke has been on the public in this case.
Right. Well, I think that the question about monetizing these is very important. We know from years and years of research on this in the mainstream media that they care about how many clicks they get. They care about their viewers on TV and so forth. That matters. That's how they sell advertising. Given the decline in subscriptions, that's a huge moneymaker for them. So that matters a lot. But sometimes it's just down to the sheer money. When the New York Times does that, you know, I have a sense that, you know, they're not just in it for the money. They want good reporting and they want the money. But BuzzFeed had a great article in the fall about a Macedonian teenager working out of his apartment, making $5,000 a week, by generating fake news on a website that was getting tons of traffic, and it was all pro-Trump information. The interview said he does not care who wins, but he knows what makes money. And so we have to be aware and cautious of the sources that we're using.
And it's an interesting point there that you've kind of touched on, because as I was looking back at articles about fake news, I was finding that before the election, there was a lot of reporting on the idea that maybe conservatives were a little more susceptible because the article seemed to be more pro-Trump and anti-Hillary, and maybe seemed to be, if not changing people's minds, maybe getting them motivated. And now there's reporting showing that after President Trump has been sworn into office, there's a lot more fake news, which seems to be trying to appeal to people on the left and seems to be getting them to believe a lot of things which are simply not true. I'm wondering if maybe the phenomenon here is that the people who are of a party which is out of power are more desperate to believe things which are not true about those who are in power.
I think that everybody wants information that's going to reinforce what they already believe. It's a natural tendency that we have. It's not natural for us to seek out information that causes us psychological conflict. As a result, I don't think it's liberals or conservatives. I think it's just people. I think that's the way we're wired. And that it takes extra education, extra critical thinking skills that are so important for our students, but also important for the rest of the population. We really need to be better and proactive in terms of saying, how do you evaluate information? What makes sense in terms of the credibility of news sources generally, so that people can gain an awareness of their own biases and then respond in an appropriate way in terms of evaluating the quality of information from both sides of the aisle?
I think it's interesting to note the role of journalism within the rise of fake news. And that is what Pete had mentioned earlier on. The news organizations are tracking the number of hits on a news site, how many people share a news story, how many people watch their news video. All of these analytics are incredibly important to the success of news organizations now. And because of that, there is certainly an added emphasis on page views and on audience attention. And does that create some hype where there shouldn't be? I'm sure that's the case, depending on the story and depending on the news outlet. Does it mean that the headline might be a little bit more sensational? Again, I'm sure depending on the outlet and the situation, we could find ample evidence. And so I think that that's created an atmosphere in which even mainstream news organizations have struggled to be neutral, and particularly in a climate where we have highly partisan news organizations, and they're overtly so. You know, we're your site for the conservative news, we're your site for liberal news, right. and lots of panelists and lots of pundits. That's no secret. We'll get back to the party papers of what you were mentioning earlier, and yet this seems to also, I think, blur the lines more between legitimate news and fake news, and certainly they're distinctly different, and the intentions of mainstream news organizations are not to promote fake news, but I think some of the current setting definitely makes it easier for people to get confused about what's what.
So, what should set off the fake news detector in the reader out there who comes across something in their Facebook feed or elsewhere? What should make them question just a little bit more than they would if it was, coming from the newspaper they read when they were growing up?
Are Pete and I allowed to do our alarm sound now?
Sure.
Our siren?
So I have a few things that, as I've been looking at reporting on this, recommendations that people have, just looking at my own experience where I've been duped and say, wow, you know, I run across these things all the time. One is look for headlines that have lots of capital letters. If they have lots of capital letters, that's basically the internet version of screaming. They're trying to evoke an emotion in you. So just be cautious when you see lots of caps. If you see headlines that use lots of hyperbolic words, like destroy and hate and ruin. I mean, those kinds of things, those are trying to evoke a strong emotional response. I suggest being really careful about when you see a headline or a story that appears to reinforce the stereotypes you have of other people. If you see a news story and say about what Trump people did and you say, I always knew they were like that, be careful, because that story in and of itself might have a germinating idea in it that actually is not true. And this is actually what we've seen in some of the recent reporting, is that this is kind of what dupes people, both on the left and the right, but it occurs in both places.
I love the word choice, too, of dupes people, in that even if you're reading something and you agree with it, it makes you feel good. Yeah, I knew that candidate was an idiot or whatever. I hope that we can appeal to people's own sense of being used, so that these fake news sites are using you no matter what persuasion you are politically or in terms of your opinion. I hope it gives people the added incentive to take a moment and think, does this just sound too good to be true? I think that's one great, you know, test for is it fake news or not. Another one is just look at the site beyond the capital letters and the screaming words and, by the way, also the exclamation points. Some of them look quite sophisticated. And right. I would look at the website of origin and look at it really closely. There's a common one that says abcnews.com.co. And so you might go, oh, it's abcnews.com. No, it's not. And so looking at the website of origin, by the way, if you go to that website and you cannot find the location of the news organization, that should be a huge red flag. Every bona fide news organization has a mailing address, and it's not a P.O. box. Another one would be check the byline, meaning the person or people who authored the article in question. That's an incredibly helpful way to, you can quickly search them and find out if they even exist. Sometimes their author pages will be such that it'll say they won the Pulitzer Prize. Well, that's also an easy check. There's also some great fact-checking sites out there. You know, you've mentioned Politico, factcheck.org. Snopes has been around since the mid-90s. S-N-O-P-E-S is a, you know, there's some very good...
PolitiFact is another one.
Thank you, PolitiFact. Yeah.
These are all ones that, especially Fact Check and PolitiFact, they kind of have their own biases. They like to check the work of other people on the other side. And so there's a kind of
a
regression to the mean in that. And a lot of my conservative friends have become increasingly suspicious of Snopes, however. Oh. They recognize Snopes, and I've been using it for years, but they say, look, these are Democratic contributors.
Oh, good
so,
to know.
I mean,
good
just,
to know.
It's just good to know what the, what the bias of any even your fact-checking sources is.
I had one other tip, and that is to think about the support. Who are the sources named in the story? Because sometimes they are really pretty hysterical. Once you read past the headline, which, as you had noted, most people don't. And so if you start reading, that's when the reading can get really good and lively, and you realize, oh, this is a joke or a parody, or they never expected anyone to read beyond the first sentence. And all you need to do is look at, is there such a thing as this department or this office? Or I think a dolphin was one source that was quoted in a DC story.
I went to one source recently where I looked at the source and I clicked through in the sources that it claimed, and it took me to a different story. And then that story on the other site gave its sources, and I clicked through that story and it took me back to the first site. So there was a complete cycle where they were reinforced, two different sites using the sites to reinforce each other. No independent sourcing.
Peter Wielhauer is a professor of political science at Western Michigan University. Sue Ellen Christian is a professor of journalism at Western. Thank you both for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gordon.
A panel discussion hosted by WMU Libraries is called How to Catch Fake News Before It Catches You. Sue Ellen Christian and Peter Wielhauer will be joined by MLive regional news manager Mickey Shikilo for that program. It begins at 7 o'clock Monday evening in the Lee Honors College Lounge. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. There were seven races for Michigan House in 2016 where more than $1 million was spent trying to elect candidates. Three of those were in Southwest Michigan. The Michigan Campaign Finance Network has analyzed the spending in last year's state house campaigns. Greg Mauger is the director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, and he joins us from Lansing. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you explain, first of all, when you talk about the most expensive, what are the things that you're looking at that add up and get these totals?
Yeah, so what we look at are basically three buckets of spending. One, spending and fundraising, that is. One bucket is what the candidates' campaigns raise and spend. So the candidate for the race, you know, pays for TV ads touting his or her own campaign, that would fall in that bucket. Another bucket is independent spending reported to the state. So these are groups that don't give money directly to the candidates, but instead spend the money independently of the candidates on TV ads, mailers, canvassing door to door. That's the second bucket. The third bucket, and which is a bucket that's growing larger and larger cycle by cycle, is spending that is not reported to the state as a campaign finance expense, but is instead spending that is primarily done on TV ads by groups that aren't telling you directly how to vote, but are telling you this candidate's great or this candidate's bad, and they're doing it through TV ads. And the only way we have to track that spending is by going to the TV stations' disclosures that they make to the federal government and tracking how many TV purchases these groups have made.
So your headline on your press release says that 2016 Michigan House races are the most expensive on record. By how much? How much did they beat the previous record by?
Yeah, so we've been tracking this for many cycles. Our organization's been around for 20 years, and what we've seen is just an increased cycle over cycle in spending in the state house campaigns. 2016 cycle, we tracked $27 million in total spending across all the races, general and primary, for the 110 seats. The previous high was 2 years ago in 2014, where we tracked $25.4 million. So, I mean, that's an increase of $1.6 million. That's a pretty significant number. When you go back a few more cycles, you can see how large the increase has been over time. In 2010, we tracked just $20.5 million. So in 6 years, it's gone from $20.5 million to $27 million, a $6.5 million increase.
Can some of the increase between 2014 and 2016 be explained by the fact that there was no race for governor on the ballot in Michigan last year, no race for U.S. Senate, the state Senate is not up again until 2018, so therefore there's a lot of money out there and it has to find somewhere to go?
It could be explained by that. I think that could be part of it, but still, if you compare 2016 over 2012, which is a similar cycle where the spending focuses on the state house campaigns, in 2012, the total was $24.3 million. So 2016 is up significantly over that. I mean, it will be interesting to see what happens in 2018, where there are going to be competitive races up and down the ballot, to see what that impact will be on the state house races. But what you said is definitely a factor.
So let's look at these three races in Southwest Michigan where $1 million or more was spent. And we'll begin with the 61st District. That includes the city of Portage and was the second most expensive state house race last year. Republican Brant Eyden won re-election by defeating Democrat John Fisher. Now, a lot of the money for Fisher went to TV issue advertising, and then the money spent for Eyden was reported on independent expenditures. So are these kind of two different strategies, really, then, for how these candidates were putting their resources to work, or where people were putting the resources to work for them?
From race to race and district to district, the numbers show up differently. In some of the races, the spending is primarily done by the state parties on TV ads that fall outside of the traditional campaign finance disclosure requirements. So that's the issue at TV spending that we track. In some races, the spending is primarily done by the caucuses themselves, the House Republicans or the House Democrats, and that would fall in the realm of a direct contribution to the candidate or an in-kind contribution to the candidate. But what you can see in the 61st is that Republican forces spent very heavily to try to protect Brant Eyden. Across all of the candidates, I believe Eyden received the most support of all Republican candidates of anyone, and he's an incumbent that they were trying to protect, and they knew that race was going to be close, and it ended up being somewhat close. So, I mean, their polling was probably right.
The 66th District includes Van Buren County and also part of Kalamazoo County. Democrat Annie Brown lost, despite the fact that actually more money was spent on her campaign. How rare is it that the candidate who raises and spends the most money ends up not winning?
Yeah, two factors on that. Usually, the candidate who spends the most money or has the most money on his or her side wins. I think we tracked this past cycle 91% of the time the candidate with the most money won. There are some exceptions, and usually those exceptions are in these competitive races where the party out of power is trying to unseat the party that's in power. The Republicans have controlled this seat for a long, long time. It's a Republican seat, so I think Democrats realize if they are going to flip the seat, they needed to spend a lot of money, and they did indeed spend a lot of money trying to flip the seat, and they were once again unsuccessful.
The 62nd district includes Battle Creek, and this saw one of the closest races in the state by the time it was all said and done. Republican John Bison won re-election by defeating Democrat Jim Hodzma. And in this case, Hodzma spent just a little bit less than Bison did. So this is one of those that falls in the mean. But I guess the question may be one of second-guessing the Democrats here about where they put their resources, given that this was a seat the Democrats held the 6 years before Bison won it.
Yeah, I think this is a seat that Democrats believed they were going to win, and I think this is a seat the Republicans thought they were probably going to lose, and it ended up that they narrowly held it. Both sides spent about the same amount of money on this seat. I mean, I thought it was interesting how close the total was. I think it was like a few thousand dollars off, if I'm remembering correctly. Both sides spent very similar amounts, and the result was very close. I mean, this is a 50-50 seat. This is a seat that's going to continually show up in these rankings as we go forward here for years to come.
What do we know about who contributed, who was spending a lot of money on these state house races?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of the traditional groups that we see cycle over cycle. I was just working on a piece today kind of about that. And on the Republican side, there was a lot of business executives' families that tended to be the largest givers. The DeVos family was the largest family unit in terms of giving to the House Republican Campaign Committee, the main campaign arm of the House Republicans by far. The House Republicans benefited heavily from DeVos family giving. Some PACs that the DeVos family funds heavily also played a large role in these elections. But there are other groups as well. Blue Cross Blue Shield gave a lot of money to the House Republicans this cycle. On the Democratic side, the big funders were the traditional Democratic funders, the labor groups, the Michigan Education Association, the Michigan Association for Justice, the United Auto Workers, and the MEA being the labor groups. Those are the three largest funders on the Democratic side.
What is hard to find or maybe impossible to find when you're putting together a report like this in terms of who is contributing? What are the things that still remain secret out there, even several months after the election's been conducted?
Yeah, I mean, it took us months to put this together, how much this total price tag of the House races. It took a long time to put this together, and we had to pour through thousands of pages of disclosures made to the federal government by TV stations on the ad time that they sold these campaigns. What remains unknown and what will always be unknown is who funded millions of dollars in dark money mailers, dark money TV ads that tried to influence these races. The Michigan Republican Party, the Michigan Democratic Party, each spent about $1 million on TV ads where it doesn't appear clear that we know where the money came from. So that's $1 million of influence from each party that could have come from one person, could have come from a few select groups that are also trying to influence public policy. We have no idea where that money came from. And then when you look at the mailers, when you look at the robocalls that people get, there's no effective way to track those. If a mailer tells you that a candidate is the worst and for all these reasons this person is bad, or this candidate is great for all these reasons this person is great, the donors behind them don't have to be disclosed. Disclosure in Michigan is based around the advertisement or communication telling you expressly how to vote. Vote for this person, vote against this person, support this person, oppose this person. Those are the magic words that mean the donors have to be disclosed. If the communication doesn't say that directly, there's a likelihood that the donors don't have to be disclosed to the state.
Craig Monger, as always, thank you for your time.
Gordon, thank you so much.
Craig Mauger is the director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. He joined us from Lansing. A longer version of the interview and links to the Michigan Campaign Finance Network's data on 2016 state house races can be found at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.